You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been over four decades since the Khmer Rouge imposed its brutal genocide on Cambodia, but that's still the image most Americans retain of the Southeast Asian country. Although it has come some distance since that horrific period, much of Cambodia's story since the 1970s continues to be a complicated and generally not very hopeful one. Joel Brinkley has written extensively about its modern history in his latest book, Cambodia's Curse, which is published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Brinkley back to our show today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You won a Pulitzer Prize for your coverage of Cambodia in 1979. What struck you most about what the country is like today compared to back then?
When I went back for the first time in 2008, I hadn't been there in almost 30 years, and I was actually quite struck, first by the modern look of the cities, but then when I got out of the cities, I found a people who lived more or less as they did 1,000 years ago, with no electricity, no toilets, no radio, no television, nothing. And these were a people who, even 30 years after the Khmer Rouge, were still traumatized by that period.
And you write, far more than any other state, modern Cambodia is a product of customs and practices set in stone a millennium ago. So what does that mean? Because I remember that one of the goals of the Khmer Rouge was to return the country to its traditional agrarian ways. Had it ever left its traditional agrarian ways?
Mostly not. And in fact, what happened, the way it worked 1,000 years ago during the Angkor period of the kings, when the people would grow rice, one of the king's mandarins, rice was the currency, the king's mandarins would come collect the rice. The low-level mandarin would take some for himself and pass it up to the next level, take some for himself, and then on it would go up to the king, who would take the bulk of it. That was corruption, the birth of corruption in Cambodia 1,000 years ago, and it works exactly the same way today.
You say that about half of the GDP winds up going in the pockets of the people who run the country?
Well, the GDP is a fiction. Nobody sees the budget, and businesses are taxed. But what happens is if you're a business and the tax man will come, he'll tell you you owe $25,000 in taxes, but if you pay me $23,000, then you don't have to pay any taxes. And then he gives part of that $23,000 to his superior, who gives some more to his next superior, and then it goes on to the top, just like the rice.
So nothing has changed since the fall of the Khmer Rouge in this regard? Did the Khmer Rouge hope to get rid of the corruption and the graft? Was that part of its goal? I mean, before it became one of the most bloodthirsty regimes in the history of the world?
There hasn't been a lot of documentation of actual corruption or anything else about the internal workings of the Khmer Rouge while they were in power. But once they left power and they were a guerrilla force in the jungles for about 10 years after 1979, they were just as corrupt as anybody else, and there was documentation about that.
It's still pretty much an agrarian society, but about one-third of the people live in the cities. The Khmer Rouge emptied out the cities, didn't they?
They did.
Who wound up going back?
80% of the population of Cambodia right now lives in the countryside, lives in impoverished surroundings, agrarian surroundings, pretty much as they did before the Khmer Rouge. The cities were – the Phnom Penh was quite large at the time the Khmer Rouge came into power because of the American bombing of Cambodia. It drove – hundreds of thousands of people into the city from the countryside to avoid being bombed. But at that time, the city was unnaturally large. It was 3 million people in a population of about 8 million. Now it has settled down, and I think there are maybe 2 million people in Phnom Penh, and there aren't any other really large cities in the state.
Well, better educated people tend to live in the cities. I don't want to make that kind of generalization, but it's kind of true. And the Khmer Rouge tried to kill off as many intellectuals as it could. So who's left and who's in the city these days?
It's been a generation and a half since the Khmer Rouge, and so there are young people, young meaning 25, 30, who have a reasonable education, but corruption affects everything in the country. You can't go to school unless you, a six-year-old cannot go to school unless he pays a bribe to the teacher every day.
Every day?
Every day. When you get into high school, if you want to take a test, the teacher will sell you the answers. So, yes, there is an educated populace, but who knows how much education they really have.
How important is the strain of Buddhism practiced there in understanding the story?
It's actually quite important. You have this people who live in the countryside who have 75% of them are illiterate. They can't read or write. They struggle survival. They live off what they can grow and what they can pick from the trees. And yet they are generally satisfied with their lives. If you ask them, the International Republican Institute does polls every couple of years across the country, and 75% of the people in Cambodia say they're satisfied with their lives. And one reason is that their strain of Buddhism, Theravadist Buddhism, teaches them, be satisfied with what you have. They don't say it this way, but it basically says don't aspire for anything more than what you have. Be happy and satisfied with what you have.
And is that why during the period that the French had it as a protectorate as part of the Union of Indochina, the Vietnamese part was constantly rebelling, but there was peace in Cambodia?
I think that is one reason. The Cambodians have been conditioned, the Khmer as they're called, have been conditioned to be satisfied with their lives and to aspire to little more for hundreds of years.
Joel Brinkley's latest book is Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land. It is published by Public Affairs. You went to Cambodia in the late 70s when you were working at the Louisville, Kentucky Courier-Journal.
Right.
I can't imagine a newspaper in a city the size of Louisville coming up with the funds to send someone to cover a conflict on the other side of the world today. In fact, even big city newspapers are resisting doing that.
That was the great old day of newspapers. A regional paper actually had an international travel budget. It's hard for me after 35 years in journalism even to remember such a moment.
When you and the photographer Jay Mather entered Cambodia, did you have any idea what you were getting into?
Very little. There wasn't a lot of coverage of it. There had been coverage of the refugees on the border, in the previous years, but nobody really wanted to believe it. There were lots of Khmer Rouge deniers, people who thought it was now a utopian capital because these people were communist and clean in the view of a lot of Europeans particularly.
Well, there were a lot of people who were sympathizing with Mao as well. I remember going to London in early, I guess it was 1972, and somebody gave me a copy of the Little Red Book.
those were the days. Yeah.
Disillusioned me. I read it and I thought, this is the silliest stuff I've ever read. But people believed it.
Absolutely true. And when I got there, there was a very brief period after the war when people paid attention to Cambodia, and then the Iran hostage crisis sort of took over the news. But what I saw was these camps full of hundreds of thousands of people, most of them still in the black pajamas of the Khmer Rouge uniform, emaciated children with swollen bellies. You can just see the scene. It was really terrible, and I was 27 years old, had never seen anything like it.
But you say the only portly people in Cambodia today are senior government ministers.
That's
so
true.
There's still a lot of malnutrition there?
10% of the nation's children are, according to UNICEF, wasting, which means they're starving to death. 40% of the children are stunted, which means they don't get enough to eat when young, and so they don't grow physically or mentally.
But how could that be in a country where 80% of the population is on the farms? You'd think they'd be producing a lot of rice.
They get into financial trouble, and a lot of them end up selling part of their land to pay medical bills, for example. And the other thing is that the government collects the rice, some of it, just as they did 1,000 years ago. They sell it abroad, pocket the money, and leave their people hungry. A couple of years ago, they sold off most of the rice that the people had grown, and then they asked an NGO to provide rice for the poor people.
Now, I'm curious about how Cambodia's form of communism developed, because it is different from other places. First of all, how did Salo Sar, the man who came to be known as Pol Pot, come to power?
When in 1970 there was a coup, and King Sihanouk, who was beloved by the people, was overthrown by by Lon Nol, who was an American puppet. And one reason that the military supported Lon Nol was that King Sihanouk had cut off relations with the United States, which means that there was no aid coming in, which means there was nothing to steal.
He was trying to steer a middle path. At least that's what he claimed.
Right. And Lon Nol just went to bed with the United States. The aid came back, and he was pretty much hated. And the Khmer Rouge was a pretty small and insignificant force when Lon Nol came to power. But then what happened was King Sihanouk, who was vain and offended, of course, by being overthrown, was in China, and he went on radio, which was broadcast across Cambodia, and encouraged his people to join the Khmer Rouge so that they could overthrow Lon Nol. Well, at that time, nobody knew what the Khmer Rouge's ambitions were, and many thousands of people joined the Khmer Rouge on behalf of their king.
Well, across the border was Vietnam. And in fact, North Vietnam was near where the Khmer Rouge were building up their forces. Was there any connection? Because there's been a long history of enmity between the two countries.
Not a great deal of connection, except that the Khmer Rouge actually hated the Vietnamese. A lot of people believe that the bombing of Cambodia by the United States during this very period encouraged people to join the Khmer Rouge.
So it's Lon Nol. We put Lon Nol in power, and then we bombed Cambodia.
Right.
And helped the Khmer Rouge become popular.
Perhaps. There's a debate about that. I think probably that the bombing did drive some people to the Khmer Rouge, but the primary reason the Khmer Rouge came to power was King Sihanouk.
I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with the atrocities that were committed during the time the Khmer Rouge was in power, but can you give us a sense of just how terribly the country had been brutalized when you arrived there in the late 70s?
The Khmer Rouge had killed 2 million people. Most of them by starvation and disease. They had driven everyone out of the cities, and they were utterly merciless. If you got married or did any of the things they said you shouldn't do, they would just drag you off and smack you on the back of the head and push you into a mass grave. It was the worst example of genocide since the 1940s.
Well, why were they killing people who had educations?
They felt threatened by them. Their view was that Cambodia needed to be returned to year zero, as Pol Pot put it. He was a lunatic. I don't know that you can – there is no rational explanation for what he did. He was a lunatic. But the only positive thing about this was that he destroyed every totem of modern-day life, but Cambodia didn't have very many facilities of modern-day life. So the infrastructure destruction was actually pretty minimal. Of course, the deaths of 2 million people is tragic.
And studies have shown that more than one-third of the Cambodians who lived through the Khmer Rouge suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, even today.
Even today, one-third to one-half. There was a study among Cambodian refugees in Long Beach, California, a pretty large population of exile Cambodians, that found a few years ago that even now 62% of these people had PTSD or other traumatic illnesses. And Cambodia is the only nation on earth. You would think that, okay, these people will die and it'll change. But Cambodia is the only place on earth that it has been shown that PTSD and other traumatic illnesses are being passed to a second generation.
Because the children of the people who went through this terrible ordeal inherit to some degree the anxieties of their parents?
They grow up in a home where the people are, where their parents are extremely traumatized and display this trauma throughout their childhoods, and they absorb it.
Joel Brinkley was at the New York Times for 23 years. Now he's a professor of journalism at Stanford University. And his latest book is Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land. It's published by Public Affairs. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Joel Brinkley, whose latest book is Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land, published by Public Affairs. Pol Pot was eventually, after 3.5 years, ousted from power by the Vietnamese. Didn't the U.S. oppose the Vietnamese invasion at the U.N.? We voted against getting rid of Pol Pot.
We voted against seating the Vietnam-appointed government of Cambodia as the U.N. representative for the state and instead left Pol Pot's representative there in the seat. The reasoning then, this is a sad story for this country.
Well, we already knew that 2 million people, or at least a lot of people, had been killed by Pol Pot's regime.
We knew that Pol Pot was a butcher, but as I mentioned, that did not get a lot of attention at that time because it was almost immediately eclipsed by the Iran hostage crisis. But the thinking, and I was the White House correspondent for the Times at this point, the thinking then was, if you give a seat in the UN to the Vietnamese government in Cambodia, then you're giving effectively another seat to the Soviet Union. And that was the preoccupying thought of the moment.
And we thought that Pol Pot's representative would be more independent?
Well, it was they saw it as a rock in a hard spot. They could have gone either way. There was no really, from their point of view, there was not a good choice, and that's the way they put it at the time.
Well, the person that the Vietnamese put in power was a former Khmer Rouge member.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I remember that the UN representative for the U.S. Had to shake his hand, and he said, I thought I needed to go wash it immediately afterwards.
The other person who would have had power would have been the king. He would have returned. Norodom Sihanouk.
Well, the Vietnamese had appointed a puppet government, and Sihanouk was still in China for most of this period. And it would have been a representative from the Vietnamese puppet government.
So where was the monarchy? Wasn't his son already in Cambodia at the time?
His son was there in the jungle fighting a guerrilla war against the Vietnamese government.
In hopes of starting a new kind of government. He didn't want to return the Khmer Rouge to power.
No, he wanted to be in power himself.
So there was eventually a power struggle.
There was a power struggle. Well, what finally happened then was that the United States, Secretary James Baker, urged the UN to take over the state for a couple of years, which they did in 92 and 93, and appointed Sihanouk as a figurehead head of state, and finally in 93 held elections, the first elections that the nation had ever had. 90% of the people voted, 90%. And but they voted and there was a deadlock, and the UN had made a mistake by saying the new government should set the election law. Well, there was no new government because there was no singular majority winner of the election. And so they almost fought a war. The UN left and then just left these squabbling politicians.
Well, how had the UN even come into Cambodia? Was there a precedent for them taking over the country? This is kind of like nation building, wasn't it?
This was the first major and the largest still today major nation building effort by the United Nations. The Cold War had ended a year or two earlier, And the UN finally wanted to show that it was relevant and could do something worthwhile for the world. So they, the Security Council, proposed this. The UN accepted it. But once they accepted it, then all the major countries that would have to fund it realized this is going to be extraordinarily expensive. So they started cutting the budget, cutting it and cutting it and cutting it until finally there was almost no money left, figuratively speaking. And so the UN still wanted to show it was relevant. It sent in its people, but not enough really to make a difference. And so they got walked over by both Khmer Rouge and Hun Sen, who was the Vietnamese prime minister. And they staged the election, but really they were not very effective.
But for while the UN was there, there were certain freedoms that have since been retracted.
While the UN occupied the country, for the first time the nation had formed civil societies, human rights groups and press freedom and this and that, and you know some of the things that are necessary for a free society. When the UN left, and finally it, over 5 or 6 years it returned to a dictatorship, the Prime Minister Hun Sen more or less left these civil societies alone because every year donor nations come in and give the country between $500 million and $1 billion. And he has to keep these relative press freedom and the civil societies going so that the donors feel that they're contributing to a country that deserves it.
Well, we'll get into the state of the economy in a moment, but I was amused by Hun Sen's title, the Noble, Supreme, Great, and All-Powerful Commander-in-Chief Prime Minister. It's the kind of thing that Idi Amin would have bestowed upon himself.
I don't think Idi Amin's would have been quite that long.
Are people aware of how silly that is?
Not in Cambodia. They think it's normal.
Other East Asian countries have gone through major economic transformations over the last few decades, including Vietnam, which is its communist dictator. And Vietnam is doing quite well economically. Why not Cambodia?
It's partly just the historical reason that people have not aspired to do more, and it is also that they are traumatized and seemingly incapable of moving beyond the state that they're in. And part of it is that the government is run by people who have no education. There were no schools outside Phnom Penh before the Khmer Rouge. And so these people who are in their 40s or 50s have no education, and they have no ambition either. I talked to many of them, and every single one of them said that the way to move the country forward was to take college graduates, move them back to the countryside so that they can help people grow rice.
And that's their goal. Well, I was shocked to read that the average income in North Korea is 3 times higher than in Cambodia.
That's true.
So this country is more isolated and mismanaged than North Korea?
Absolutely true. And one reason is that if you ask anyone in this country or in the West about Cambodia today, if you know anything about the country, you know that it was about the Khmer Rouge. And so the general feeling for anybody who pays any attention today is, oh, they're so much better off than they were during the Khmer Rouge. And so you ask people in government and they say, well, we don't really have to pay attention anymore because they're so much better off than they were under the Khmer Rouge. And under that rubric, the government can do whatever it wants and nobody notices.
And you're suggesting that they're not all that much better off except for the obvious difference that there's no genocide.
That's correct. There's a doctor who runs some children hospitals, an Irishman named Beat Richner, and he calls what's happening now silent genocide. He sees all these children who come in malnourished and diseased. 75% of the people in Cambodia are treated or not treated for dysentery every year, and 10,000 of them die every year. Diseases ripple through that country. Unimaginable diseases ripple through that country, and most people are unable to get any treatment for them. So the deaths continue.
Joel Brinkley's latest book is Cambodia's Curse, A Modern History of a Troubled Land. It's published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another country that comes to mind in thinking about Cambodia is Burma. But Burma has been made into something of a pariah, as has North Korea. But Cambodia has not. And yet it sounds to me like Cambodia is maybe in some ways in worse shape than Burma.
Well,
if that's possible.
Well, the people are more prosperous in Burma, absolutely. Hun Sen has figured out the formula for staging elections that dictators around the world have figured out, and that is you rig everything before the election. Don't let the opposition on to radio or TV. Bribe voters, do all these things, and then you hold a straight election. And the election observers come in and declare the election free and fair, because on election day people are allowed to vote, but they don't know what happened prior to that. And so he holds elections every year and portrays himself as a Democrat.
Was there no NGO presence in the country?
There's a huge NGO presence.
Aren't they aware, and aren't they passing on this information?
Yes, they are, and they're passing on the information to countries, primarily the United States, that don't really care anymore.
There was another power struggle, wasn't there, between the king and the king's son and Hun Sen? How did that work out?
In 1997.
This is after the UN left.
Right. In 1997, after the UN left, there was the way the election was finally settled was that they were co-prime ministers, Hun Sen and Prince Ranariddh, who was the king's son. And the problem was that Hun Sen had been the dictator appointed by the Vietnamese, and he controlled all the government throughout the country and all the cities and towns. And so even though Ranariddh was the co-prime minister, he didn't control anything. So finally there was a little civil war in 1997. Ranariddh started it, but he was overpowered by Hun Sen, and Hun Sen has been the dictator since.
There was a matter of who was going to get the proceeds from timber sales.
Shortly after Ranariddh and Hun Sen came into office, Cambodia has a number of – it has mahogany and all sorts of exotic wood trees. They call them luxury trees. And Ranariddh and Hun Sen sent a note to the Thai who were buying pirated lumber and said, you can only buy lumber from the Cambodian military. It was a secret letter. And, of course, the Cambodian military took the money and gave it to Hun Sen. That went on for years until finally right about now there's really no lumber left.
Thailand is getting young women from Cambodia for sex trafficking.
Well, that's true, but I wrote a series about this 10 years ago. Thailand is a source of – Thai women, particularly in the north, are sold to sex traffickers by the dozen every day. It's true that Cambodian women go to Thailand, but Thailand provides quite a number of young girls themselves.
Well, you write that in the early 2000s, across Cambodia, hundreds of women were being tricked or coerced into giving up their babies, which were then sold and eventually adopted – unknowingly by Americans. Is that still happening?
No, not that we know of. The U.S. ambassador at that time found out about it and, working with an NGO, found that the proceeds were going up the chain in the government, just like the rice proceeds 1,000 years ago, and when he confronted Hun Sen with this, Hun Sen banned all adoptions.
This is obviously a horrible story, and I'm sure the U.S. government is aware of it. Have all of the administrations since Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, all just looked the other way?
In the early 2000s, the ambassador then, a fellow named Kent Wiedemann, was appointed. And previous to that, the two ambassadors were people who had rich experience with the UN occupation and who had hoped that something positive would come of it. Kent Wiedemann was the first ambassador to come without that background, and he saw the arena he was working in and decided that Cambodia really had no strategic interest for the United States, and he would turn the goal of the American embassy would simply be to pursue human rights for the Cambodian people, which put him in direct opposition with the government at every turn. And that's more or less the way it's been ever since.
They also, until recently, resisted bringing any Khmer Rouge people up for trial. Why?
Well,
isn't the raison d'etre for Hun Sen's government the fact that he's not the Khmer Rouge?
Well, remember, he was a Khmer Rouge commander.
Yeah, but he broke with them.
Well, so he says. We don't really know. But the government is riddled with former Khmer Rouge officers. And Hun Sen has fought. The trials are underway right now. A new one resumes in June. Hun Sen has fought the process from the day one because he knows that his friends and former colleagues might eventually be brought to trial.
Are Cambodians paying attention? Are they being made aware of these tribunals?
Some people in the countryside have televisions that are powered by car batteries, and a trial was underway when I was last there. Of the head of one of the prisons that executed tens of thousands of people. And I asked people, have you been watching this? Most people said, no, I just don't have time.
And you cited a poll in which, what was it, 80% of or 75% of the people said that they were happy with the situation. You cite another poll from the Cambodia Daily in 2009 that 82% of the respondents felt the country was on the right track.
It's kind of shocking, isn't it?
Very sad. Joel Brinkley's book, Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.